The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For this hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. With this edition, the cover story is entitled The Art of the Duel by Molly Ball. The date of this issue is January 21, 2019. We go right to the back of the book to make sure that we can include this week's interview edition, which is now called Seven Questions. Time's subject is Ken Jeong. Time says, the Crazy Rich Asians actor, on his past life as a doctor, his upcoming Netflix special, and getting serious in stand-up. First question. You perform to a room of mostly people of Asian descent in your stand-up special. You complete me, Ho. Ho is spelled H-O. How did that affect the mood? Answer. The special actively captures the electricity in the room. To have a predominantly Asian crowd that night, that doesn't always happen. There was a loose feel to it. I never have a set order, but I knew where to add certain bits or improvise. What I love about stand-up is that you can just roll with it like jazz and see where it takes you. Question. The special has a lot of sincere moments, especially about your wife, Tran Ho's, facing breast cancer. Is stand-up in a place where there's room to get serious? Answer. Yes. I wanted to do something very different from my old stand-up, which was joke-based. I wanted this to be real. That coincides with today's stand-up comedy. Comics like Hannah Gadsby or Ali Wong exemplify how you can do deeply personal work in a stand-up format. It wasn't like that 20 years ago. Question. There's been a collective shift toward wanting more personal material. Answer. It's definitely for the better because you can only tell so many unmentionable jokes. You need something deeper to stay. Question. You were a doctor before getting into comedy. How did coming from a normal day job shape your perspective on Hollywood? Answer. I want to advance my career in show business, but it's only worth doing if you truly love it. The Hangover was the otherworldly thing that changed my career from black and white to Technicolor and made me famous. But Community taught me how to act. I look at it in two ways. Are you working, but also, are you growing? Question. You give a shout-out to Kevin Hart in your special, saying he's influenced your career. He's been in the headlines recently for stepping down from hosting the Oscars after some people objected anew to some of his past tweets and hurtful comments about the LGBTQ community. Have you talked to him about this? Answer. I have reached out to offer support as a friend. It's true. He inspired me to get back into stand-up. In the current situation, he's talked about evolving and learning, and I think that's what this is about. Life changes your perspective. I'm confident Kevin is earnest on that path. Only he knows where that will take him. Question. Whoopi Goldberg floated your name as an Oscars host. Are you up for the gig? Answer. The way I can make sense of it is that the success of Crazy Rich Asians is why I'm even being mentioned. The director, John Chu, calls it not a movie, but a movement. And you know that movement is real when you have names like mine being bandied about. Question. You recently attended the Golden Globes, where Sandra Oh, who was of Korean descent, co-hosted and won an award. Are you optimistic about Asian American representation? Answer. Crazy Rich Asians showed that it's profitable, but it's just one story. being at the Globes and seeing so many Asian friends there felt like how the gang from St. Elmo's Fire must have felt back in the day. This cool clique of Asian American actors who genuinely support each other. To have more Asian Americans at the forefront is the dream. We're beginning to live that. Final question. You're a judge on The Masked Singer, a new reality singing competition on Fox. Why is it important for this moment? Answer. The Korean version is my mom's favorite show. Watching that, I found myself hooked. It's just very addicting. A lot of surprises, and the format is made to make money. My mom is ecstatic. That's my Sandra Oh-ish victory there. My dad is happy because I was a doctor, and my mom is happy because I'm on The Masked Singer. Time interview with Ken Jeong, conducted by Mahita Gajanan. Going now to the front of the magazine, and we come to the lead-off feature for the record, a one-page collection of small news items, each one illustrated with a line drawing, a headline in bold, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 11 hours, 36 minutes. Caption explains, time it took K-pop star Kong Daniel to set a Guinness World Record for shortest time to rack up 1 million Instagram followers. The previous record was 12 hours, set by Pope Francis. 11 hours, 36 minutes. In the center of the right margin of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Queensland. Thousands of beachgoers stung by jellyfish in the Australian state. Under Good Week, Queen. Biopic, Bohemian Rhapsody, won Golden Globe for Best Drama. In the lower right corner of the page is a story illustrated by Abdul Fattah al-Sisi, Egyptian president, in a 60 Minutes interview. His government tried to stop CBS from airing. The quotation from Egyptian President Abdul Fattah al-Sisi, quote, in all blacks, all caps, quote, there are no political prisoners in Egypt, unquote. Caption goes on to say, Human Rights Watch estimates there are 60,000 such prisoners. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Carlos Ghosn, former Nissan Motor chairman, in his first public remarks since he was arrested in Tokyo on November 19th for allegedly lying to the Japanese government about his compensation and mismanaging company funds. The quotation from Carlos Ghosn, quote, I have been wrongly accused and unfairly detained, unquote. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 612. Caption explains, weight in pounds of a bluefin tuna that went for a record $3.1 million at a fish market auction in Tokyo on January 5th. 612 pounds. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from David Sisko, a wildlife biologist with the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources, describing George, a Hawaiian land snail that died on New Year's Day in a lab in Kalua, Oahu, at age 14. The quote from David Sisko, quote, he was a little bit of a hermit. I very rarely saw him outside of his shell, unquote. Caption goes on to say, George was the last of his species. That is Hawaiian land snail. And that lab was in Kailua, Oahu. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary statistic in bright red, $41.7 billion. Caption explains, global movie box office sales in 2018, an all-time high, $41.7 billion. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Kamala Harris, U.S. Senator, Democrat of California, describing why she became a prosecutor in her new book, The Truths We Hold. And the quotation from California Senator Kamala Harris, quote, when activists came marching and banging on the doors, I wanted to be on the other side to let them in, unquote. In the lower center of the page is a quotation from Donald Trump, U.S. President, justifying a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border in a primetime TV address on January 8th, day 18 of the partial government shutdown. And the quotation from U.S. President Donald Trump, quote, why do wealthy politicians build walls, fences, and gates around their homes? They don't build walls because they hate the people on the outside, but because they love the people on the inside, unquote. That is the entire content of the For the Record page. Going forward, we are now in the lead section called The Brief. In the right margin of the page is the feature News Ticker, consisting of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Bolton adds condition to Syria plan. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton said on January 6th that the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria, announced abruptly by President Trump in December, is conditional on Turkey's pledging not to attack Washington's Kurdish allies there. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called Bolton's remarks a, quote, serious mistake, unquote. Second item, Saudi woman appeals for asylum. Rahaf Mohammed Al-Kinun, an 18-year-old Saudi woman who flew to Thailand to escape her family in Kuwait, was granted refugee status by the UN on January 9th. Kinun said she'd renounced Islam, a crime punishable by death in Saudi Arabia. Her asylum case has been referred to Australia. Bottom item, U.S. carbon emissions spiked in 2018. Carbon emissions in the U.S. rose by 3.4% last year, the biggest increase in 8 years, according to a January 8th report from the Rhodium Group, an independent research group. The rise marks a change from recent years, when emissions fell as renewable energy became more popular. Moving ahead, and still in the brief, this section in the brief is called News, and this feature is a brief history of American teacher strikes and where Los Angeles fits in, by Katie Riley. Just as students returned to school from their winter vacations, teachers in Los Angeles were ready to leave. Working in the second largest school district in the U.S., they were prepared to go on strike after failed negotiations in their quest for smaller class sizes, higher pay, and increased funding for school counselors and nurses. The Los Angeles dispute can be seen as a sign that the issues behind last year's wave of walkouts, education cuts and low teacher pay among them, aren't resolved. But the story of teacher strikes in the U.S. goes back much further than that. Some historians have seen recent events as a resurgence of teacher activism that has roots in the 1960s and 70s. In the first half of the 20th century, the American Federation of Teachers, and the National Education Association maintained no strike policies. But as teachers face the perpetual problems of difficult working conditions and lack of support for public education, and as conditions improve for other unionized professions, many chapters ignored that practice. Teacher strikes started to occur with greater frequency. More than 50 such strikes took place from 1946 to 1949, up from only a dozen in the first half of that decade, according to the Encyclopedia of U.S. Labor and Working Class History. Teacher strikes picked up during the next 30 years, even in the face of state laws that outlawed them. There were more than 1,000 such strikes involving more than 823,000 teachers from July 1960 to June 1974, according to the same encyclopedia. By the late 1970s, 72% of public school teachers were covered by collective bargaining agreements, and union membership soared. John Shelton, an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and author of Teacher Strike, Public Education, and the Making of a New American Political Order, says several forces contributed to a spate of teacher strikes throughout the 1970s, including the fight for collective bargaining rights, conflicts over inequality in segregated schools, and political and economic pressures that simultaneously forced districts to cut costs and unions to fight for increased wages. Quote, in some cases you had teacher strikes that lasted 2 and 3 months because the teacher unions there were so pronounced, because the conflicts between the school districts and the teacher unions there were so pronounced. Unquote, Shelton says. In 1973, there were simultaneous teacher strikes in Chicago, St. Louis, and Philadelphia, the last of which lasted nearly 2 months. In 1981, teachers in Ravenna, Ohio, concluded a 5-month strike. In 1987, a teacher strike in the small town of Homer, Illinois, came to a bitter end after 8 months. To this day, it appears to hold the record for the longest teacher strike in U.S. history. But more than 30 years later, similar issues in Los Angeles reflect an unfinished battle over the rights and role of teachers. That was the entire article by Katie Riley. In the left margin of the page is another version of News Ticker, again consisting of 3 news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Manafort accused of sharing data with Russians. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort gave 2016 polling data to a business associate with ties to Russian intelligence, according to a court document unsealed on January 8th, a filing that could prove key to the investigation into possible collusion between the campaign and Russia. Second item, Hungarians rally against, quote, slave law, unquote. At least 10,000 people marched in Budapest on January 5th to protest a labor reform that allows companies to demand up to 400 hours of overtime from employees each year. Dubbed a, quote, slave law, unquote, by critics, it has united trade unions and civic groups against Prime Minister Viktor Orban's right-wing government. Final item, investigation after woman in coma gives birth. The CEO of Hacienda Healthcare, an Arizona nursing home, where a woman who has been in a vegetative state for over a decade gave birth after being sexually assaulted, resigned on January 7th. Police in Phoenix are seeking DNA from all male employees. Moving ahead, we now come to the next section called The View. The subsection is Culture, where the headline is When Bad Men Make Great Art by Stephanie Zakarik. Bohemian Rhapsody, which won 2 Golden Globes on January 6th, may as well have been directed by a ghost. One of his producers, as he accepted the award for Best Motion Picture Drama, avoided mentioning that director's name, just as its star had done earlier. If only the film had directed itself, it would have been so much more convenient. The man with the director's credit, Bryan Singer, was fired from Bohemian Rhapsody approximately 2 weeks before shooting had finished, reportedly for failing to show up on set on numerous occasions. But perhaps more significant was the news that broke just after Singer was fired. The filmmaker was facing a lawsuit connected with an allegation that he'd sexually assaulted a 17-year-old at a yacht party in 2003. That news, and rumors about Singer's predatory behavior in Hollywood, all of which he has denied, reinforced the filmmaker's place in an ever-growing category in the world of entertainment. Singer is now what we call, quote, problematic, unquote. If you've gone to the movies any time in the past 30 years, you've probably encountered one of these problematic figures. And within just the past few months, you've probably heard about how Kevin Hart withdrew from hosting the Oscars after a series of homophobic tweets from 2010 and 2011 resurfaced. Or of how about comedian and actor Louis C.K., accused of sexual harassment in 2017, has faced criticism as he attempts a comeback. Now, as we round the final bend of the Oscars race, it's hardly surprising that no one involved with Bohemian Rhapsody wants to talk about Singer. A malignant form of common sense has taken hold. Art made by allegedly bad people must be damned outright. Society, especially as reflected on social media, now demands that anyone who loves a film must do so with an asterisk. Caveats of this sort are piling up, and as they do, they become the enemy of art, a specter force dogging even our initial unconscious response to work. Not to mention any more thoughtful and nuanced mention that might follow. If you've ever enjoyed a Bryan Singer movie, or a Woody Allen movie, or a Bernardo Bertolucci movie, or any movie produced by Harvey Weinstein, you would now better append at least one qualification to your reaction. Quote, I liked, insert movie name here, but in no way do I condone the behavior of insert name here, unquote. Instead of just processing what a film or performance means, our declarations of love or even just admiration have become more like legal briefs, multi-page documents with clauses and riders attached that must outweigh whatever we appreciated about the work itself. And there's always someone ready to call out a perceived sin of omission. No one wants to be seen as granting approval to either known or accused abusers, rapists, or pedophiles. And it's normal to feel some aggravation when we see these people, even if their alleged crimes are as yet unproven, continuing to get work. We're hardwired, maybe, to want our artists to deserve our respect and the movie-going dollars we funnel toward them. It's impossible to divorce our feelings about an artist from things we heard he did. But while I don't feel comfortable with the rumors I've heard about Singer, when I look at Bohemian Rhapsody, I don't see some pure auteurist vision. I see a creation that works because a bunch of musicians and choreographers, lighting technicians and camera people, not to mention actors, knew what they were doing and believed in it. All big-budget movies bear the fingerprints of many hands, including those of a director. But art is alchemy. There's so much that can go wrong, and also a million and one nearly imperceptible elements that have to somehow go right. These days, I don't feel comfortable with much of anything except the word uncomfortable. The wrestling comes with the territory. Stasis is death. Even deeply imperfect artists are capable of delighting viewers or of making us see darkness in ourselves. It's hard work to be a moral custodian every moment, but it's even harder and far more worthwhile to acknowledge darkness and light at once, in or surrounding the same film, or painting, or book, or piece of music. Nuance and complexity, and the hope that a work will open some previously hidden door inside us, are part of what draw us to art in the first place. Reckoning with contradiction is what makes us most alive, if only because it requires more energy than simply registering our disapproval. Entire article by Stephanie Sikarik. In the right margin of this page is the recurring feature, Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. There are three examples listed here, stacked one on top of the other. Top item, when American troops leave. Lena Khatib of the think tank Chatham House argues that U.S. soldiers quickly exiting Syria would undermine a Trump promise to contain Iran's influence. Khatib writes that the administration may assume a U.S. withdrawal would weaken Russia and others' ties with Iran, but would actually, quote, give Iran time and space to consolidate its presence, unquote. Middle item, freedom money. People living under authoritarian regimes have started to recognize the potential of Bitcoin, writes the Human Rights Foundation's Alex Gladstein, pointing to groups in China and Venezuela that use the cryptocurrency to avoid tight financial controls. Bottom item, the upside of the moon. Times' Jeffrey Kluger hopes that China's putting a lander and rover on the dark side of the moon, a region that until then was untouched, will inspire a new era of international space competition and, quote, focus the American mind on space once again, unquote. The next up is the Risk Report, where the headline is, the top 10 risks for 2019 suggest a gathering storm, by Ian Bremmer. He writes, the geopolitical environment is most dangerous it's been in decades, and yet the global economy is mostly doing well. What's wrong with this picture? Nothing yet. While the most serious risks, such as cyber war with Russia or military confrontation with Iran, are more plausible than they've been, none are particularly likely to play out in 2019. But we are heading for serious, longer-term trouble down the road. That's the first of my Eurasia Group's top 10 risks this year. Number 1. Bad seeds take root. 2010 is the year bad seeds are being planted that will eventually threaten the entire global order. Examples? The Transatlantic Alliance, NATO, the European Union, the G20, the World Trade Organization, U.S., China, Russia, and the West. none of these will explode this year, but every one of them is headed in the wrong direction. Number two, U.S. versus China. The U.S.-China relationship is broken, and even a truce in the trade war won't fix it. Trust between the two sides is almost gone. The U.S. agrees China poses threats. The Chinese believe they can't afford to back down. Both sides will work to make themselves less vulnerable to the other by reducing the connections that bind them together. Number three, the cyber gloves are off. There are still no realistic rules of the road to help avoid cyber conflict. It's hard to halt an attack. You can't tell who's shooting at you. Your cyber defenses fast become obsolete. And 2019 will be the year the U.S. government goes on offense. Number four, popular marches on. Populism marches on in Europe. The EU will hold parliamentary elections in May, and populists will score a victory that will help them challenge current European policy on migration, trade, and enforcement of EU rules inside member states. Number five, the U.S. at home. Infighting in Washington will be especially intense in 2019. Trump will face challenges from House Democrats, the media, the courts, and investigations of his administration, his campaign, his businesses, and his family. Trump will return fire, raising the risk of a constitutional crisis. Number six, the winter of our innovation. Security fears persuade governments to avoid foreign suppliers. Privacy concerns lead them to tightly regulate how citizens' data can be used. Economic worries lead them to build barriers to protect their firms against foreign competitors. We see these trends in U.S.-China relations, but also in Europe, Japan, Brazil, India, and even in California. Innovation depends on cooperation. Expect less of that in 2019. Number seven, coalition of the unwilling. Donald Trump now has imitators in Italy's Matteo Salvini and Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro. Russia's Vladimir Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un have tactical reasons to promote the U.S. president. Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman and Israel's Bibi Netanyahu need his support. These leaders don't salute a common flag, but each will bolster Trump's challenge to the status quo. Number eight, a leftist in Mexico. New president Andrés Manuel López Obrador is popular, but his bid to roll back macroeconomic policies, privatization, and deregulation threaten a return to the 1960s. In 2019, he'll spend money Mexico doesn't have on problems like poverty and security that resist straightforward solutions. Number nine, tensions in Ukraine. Ukraine will hold a presidential election in March and a parliamentary vote in the fall. Russia will interfere to a far greater degree than in U.S. and European elections. Each has political incentives to pick fights with the other. Though both want to limit their battles, conflict can take on a life of its own. Number 10, Nigeria on a knife edge. If the ineffective president, Muhammadu Buhari, wins this year's fiercely contested election, much-needed reforms must wait, and militant attacks will worsen. His opponent, Atiku Abubakar, wants mainly to enrich himself and his allies in office. The wild card risk? An inconclusive result, followed by violence and chaos. That was the entire risk report. That brings us now to the cover article, which is a part of the section called Nation. The headlines, The Stakes of the Showdown. The first battle between President Trump and Speaker Nancy Pelosi will shape the new balance of power in Washington, by Molly Ball. A new year has dawned in Washington, and this is what it looks like. A partial government shutdown in its third week, a new Congress sworn in only to sit on its hands, an emboldened House Speaker Nancy Pelosi refusing to cede an inch, and an angry President Donald Trump abandoning negotiations to take to television and make the case for crisis measures. Federal offices and museums are shuttered. Trash is piling up in national parks. Airport security personnel are working without pay. Recipients of housing aid are wondering if they'll soon be evicted. But step back from the sordid details, and you could hardly get a more accurate tableau of America's new political reality, a non-functioning federal government whose leaders, each insisting the stakes are too high to bulge, have retreated to their corners. At the center of the drama are the two towering figures whose clash will define the next biennium, Trump and Pelosi. The yin and yang of a divided America, two powerful leaders with their credibility on the line, both convinced they hold the winning hand. Neither can afford to lose. Trump has, after 2 years of distraction and delay, finally called the question of his signature policy promise, a wall on the southern border, which he insists must be a literal barrier made of concrete or steel. The wall is unpopular with the public and disdained by experts on both sides of the immigration debate. But the president is obsessed with playing to his hardcore base of supporters and with his own self-image as a dominant alpha male. And caving would be an epic humiliation that could render him a premature lame duck and weaken his position ahead of a tough re-election campaign. Trump had been, if you will, pushed to the wall. Pelosi takes up the first battle of her new speakership with a fired-up Democratic majority that saw the midterm results as a mandate to take on Trump and a repudiation of his stance on immigration, which she made the focus of the election's closing days. The San Francisco Congresswoman is legendary for her legislative savvy, having recently stamped out murmurs of dissent in her ranks. But that may be less of an asset with an outsider president who ignores traditional incentives. Trump has insisted that unpaid federal workers aren't really bothered, and even suggested he'd keep the government shuttered for months or even years. How does even the savviest negotiator deal with a president with such an unusual tolerance for conflict, uncertainty, and the suffering of others? The first Oval Office address of Trump's presidency had the feel of a defensive maneuver. On the night of January 8th, he raced woodenly through a prepared text, sounding a familiar note that migration from Mexico constitutes an urgent national security threat. Quote, "This is a humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the heart and a crisis of the soul," unquote, he intoned as the camera zoomed in on his face. The president reportedly didn't want to give the primetime address, but his advisers convinced him that making the argument to the public was his best hope to shift the momentum of a fight he seemed to be losing. The next day in the Senate, the president tried to make the sale to his own party, where cracks were beginning to show. The GOP leader, Mitch McConnell, had insisted that no bill to break the impasse would be considered without Trump's endorsement. But purple state Republicans had begun to voice public support for the Democrats' position of reopening the government without allocating money for a border barrier. These senators know that experts believe a physical wall isn't feasible or effective in some areas of the border, that the wall has never enjoyed majority support in public opinion polls, and that illegal cross-border migration has dipped to historically low levels, replaced by a humanitarian crisis of asylum seekers hindered by the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policies, some of which courts have ruled unlawful. With the House in Democratic hands, the president can hardly afford an erosion of support in the Republican-controlled Senate. Trump spent 2 years content to punt on the wall, sometimes telling his cheering crowds it was already under construction, sometimes declaring himself content with other solutions. This time, Trump could have pivoted from the dismal midterm result to a new posture of bipartisanship. He could have sought a bargain like the one Democrats offered him a year ago, in which undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children would get citizenship in exchange for a wall funding subsidy as large as $25 billion. In the past, he's repeatedly been talked out of forcing a shutdown, most recently in late September, when White House and Capitol Hill advisors successfully pleaded with him not to insert more drama into the height of the political season and Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh. In December, he nearly allowed himself to be diverted again, tweeting that border security had already improved and the military would be building the wall as the Senate unanimously passed wall-free government funding. But after an outcry from the right, Trump reversed himself and finally got the fight he wanted. Democrats, for their part, tried once before to use a shutdown to force a popular change in immigration policy, but last time they lost their nerve after just a few days. That was before Pelosi was in charge of the House. Now, Democrats believe they already did all the compromising they needed to last year. Pelosi has unified her caucus in Senate Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer, behind her hardball strategy. In an awkward tag-team response to Trump's address, the two Democrats stood before a row of American flags and argued that Trump was, quote, holding the American people hostage, unquote, with a manufactured crisis. If Pelosi's nerve falters and she cedes ground, she would immediately risk losing the confidence of the fractious caucus she's labored to control. But if she succeeds in her standoff with Trump, it will be an important moment in Washington, a signal that Congress, which has spent the past 2 years kowtowing to the president, now has the power to thwart him. That momentum would carry forward into numerous investigations the House is preparing to unleash. Trump didn't invent Washington gridlock. Plenty of other moments in his presidency have felt equally do or die, only to be subsumed and forgotten amid the next high-stakes crisis. Hours before Trump's Oval Office address, new evidence emerged of his former campaign chairman's communications with an aide of the FBI, with an aide the FBI has linked to Russian intelligence. At the end of the month, the president, assuming he can afford to fuel up Air Force One, is scheduled to travel to the annual meeting of economic elites in Davos, Switzerland, where he'll confront the world order he continues to jumble and destabilize, an arguably bigger deal than 9 shuttered government departments. Perhaps it was inevitable that a president whose administration has been in a state of virtual breakdown since its inauguration should preside over the government itself grinding to a halt. Trump true to his tendencies, acts on impulse, prevaricates, shreds norms, and takes unilateral actions of questionable legality. He stumbles into authoritarianism not out of calculation, but out of machismo. Meanwhile, the speaker, true to her tendencies, unites her wayward party behind a carefully chosen, logical course of action, but her best-laid plans may still be no match for an extraordinary moment. Ultimately, it is fitting that Trump, avatar of chaos, should face off against Pelosi, master of rules. And there's no end in sight for the clash of these two titanic figures. Also in The Nation, this article is entitled, "It's Not Just About the Wall, It's About Trump's Future," by Brian Bennett and Tessa Berenson. Donald Trump's guests had barely settled into their seats in the Oval Office for negotiations to end the federal government shutdown when the president went on the attack. He would not budge below the more than $5 billion he had demanded for a border wall, he told Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on January 4th. He was happy to keep the government partly shuttered for months or even years, he said. And then he really went off. Quote, "Why don't you use this for impeachment," unquote, Trump shot at Pelosi, according to his own account of the conversation. Pelosi, who had assumed formal control of the House the day before, told him they weren't there to discuss that. But the moment was a tell. Trump knows that more is at stake in his negotiations with Democrats than funding for the, quote, "big, beautiful wall," unquote, he promised on the campaign trail. In a city obsessed with power, there was a new balance of forces in Washington, and the funding battle has escalated into a fight over who will have the upper hand. If Trump wins, the White House sees a chance to divide his Democratic critics ahead of a fractious presidential primary, blunt their efforts to use investigations to weaken him, and strengthen his hand on the legislative front. On the flip side, the White House officials fear any concessions on Trump's signature campaign promise, heightens the danger from oversight probes, and makes it harder to work together on measures Trump has endorsed, such as reducing drug prices and increasing spending on transportation and infrastructure needs. In many ways, this is a battle Trump himself has chosen to fight on an issue aides say he cares about deeply. Politics has always been a zero-sum game for him. The difference now is that he faces a powerful opponent, and he has a lot more to lose. It didn't have to be this way. In December, Trump signaled he was open to signing a temporary government funding package that didn't include border wall money, which passed the Senate unanimously and looked set to sail through the House to his desk. But then, under fire from right-wing commentators, Trump reversed himself. After a last-minute scramble in Congress failed, about a quarter of the federal government ceased to function just in time for Christmas. Trump's challenge only became starker as the Democrats took control of the House in January. So he turned to the bully pulpit in search of victory. The president surprised a group of immigration officers and Border Patrol agents in an Oval Office meeting January 3rd, insisting they describe the need for a border wall directly to the White House press corps and walking them onto the briefing room podium. The next day, after his feisty meeting with Pelosi and Schumer, Trump abruptly decided to hold an hour-long news conference on a chilly afternoon in the Rose Garden, during which he said he would consider the extraordinary step of using emergency powers to build a border wall if Democrats refused to fund one. Trump pressed his case on his first ever primetime Oval Office address on January 8th and planned a trip to the Texas-Mexico border later that week. Trump's team has argued that the president is protecting American citizens from violence and terrorism. Quote, I believe we made progress in establishing the fact that we do have a humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border, unquote, Vice President Mike Pence told a small group of support reporters on January 7th of his meetings with Democrats. Pence confirmed that the White House counsel's office is, quote, looking at, unquote, ways to legally use emergency funding for a wall. Quote, there's a real sense of urgency, unquote, echoed Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. Quote, the crisis is getting worse, unquote. Behind the scenes, however, there are few signs that these arguments are swaying Trump's opponents. During discussions over the weekend of January 5th and 6th, more than 40 aides from the White House and both parties on the Hill tried to hammer out a deal in Pence's office. Democrats grilled Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, over the exact parameters of Trump's position. When Pence arrived on January 6th, nearly an hour late, he brought a three-page outline of White House demands, which extended beyond wall funding to include more money to hire immigration officers and Border Patrol agents, and added bed space for immigration detention facilities. Democrats were unmoved. Then, on January 9th, Trump ended a Situation Room meeting with Schumer and Pelosi when the Speaker said she wouldn't agree to fund his wall. The stakes are rising. Some 800,000 employees across nine federal departments and multiple agencies have been furloughed or working without pay since December 22nd. If the two sides don't come to an agreement by January 11th, many workers won't get a paycheck. Federal housing subsidies for the poorest Americans are in question. National parks are straining to continue operations, and airport officials have raised security concerns as some Transportation Security Administration screeners have declined to show up for work. If the impasse stretches to January 12th, it will become the longest government shutdown on record. For now, Trump is taking the brunt of the blame in polls. Some 51% of Americans think Trump bears most of the responsibility, according to an early January Reuters-Ipsos poll, up 4 percentage points from a similar poll run in late December. Even among Republicans, Trump's actions aren't as popular as his policy. 77% of Republicans support a border barrier, but just 54% say they support Trump shutting the government over it. Democrats are confident Trump's PR offensive won't win over the public. Both sides worry that caving on this issue will set the power dynamic for the next 2 years, which means this shutdown may set its own kind of precedent. Entire article by Brian Bennett and Tessa Berenson, with reporting by Elena Abramson, Molly Ball, and Philip Elliott, Dateline, Washington. Accompanying this article is a sidebar article. Headline is, House Democrats Gird to Fight Trump and Each Other, by Elena Abramson. On the first day of the 116th Congress, newly elected House Speaker Nancy Pelosi declared a set of principles for divided government. For the first time, House Democrats have the power to investigate the Trump administration, and Pelosi wanted to tell the nation her party would act responsibly. In a speech on the House floor, she emphasized trust, duty, and bipartisanship. She quoted Ronald Reagan and paid homage to George H.W. Bush, and she did not once mention President Donald Trump. The message did not last a day. That afternoon, Democratic Representative Brad Sherman took the floor and reintroduced articles of impeachment against Trump. Then, at a reception for the liberal group MoveOn.org that night, incoming Representative Rashida Tlaib greeted activists with a message very different from Pelosi's sober promises. "We're going to, quote, we're going to go in there," unquote, she announced to the cheering crowd, quote, "and we're going to impeach the," expletive deleted by your reader, unquote. It was exactly the tone Pelosi and her lieutenants were determined to avoid as the Trump presidency enters a new chapter, and top Democrats were apoplectic, quote, "We couldn't even make it 24 hours in the majority before we did something so transparently partisan," unquote, complained a chief of staff to one House Democrat. It's not that Pelosi and her aides favor politeness over throwing punches. It's about the effective use of newfound power. Interviews with five new House committee chairs and a dozen congressional aides and experts advising them reveal a broad and detailed Democratic plan to investigate the Trump administration on everything from its deregulation of the financial services industry to its family separation policy at the U.S.-Mexico border, and to pursue the ongoing probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. And this is your dedicated reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you for joining us once again and thanking you for your patience through your reader's performance today. Please join us next time for Time.